All right, everyone, welcome to another episode of Options Discovery. Today, I'm sitting down with Eric Kott, the president of Kott Consulting. Eric, can you give us an overview of your background and how you got to where you are today?
Sure. First off, it's a pleasure to be here, Esma. I want to thank Dr. John, as I used to refer to him. He's a real great mentor of mine. John and the Luthien team, it's been an incredible success that they've had. I came a circuitous way to the derivative space. I was actually on my way to law school before my daughter was born, and I worked at a very, very large corporate law firm, Simpson Thacher in New York City. I actually had a slight stint in the public sector. I worked in the district attorney in New York. My 15 minutes of fame was making copies for John Jr., John Kennedy Jr. He was in frauds. I was in rackets. I guess I fought the urge on my way to go to law school. I fought the urge to get into finance because I have three great mentors. That's my father, Barry, my older brother, Noel, and my middle brother, Andrew, all municipal guys. But they sort of convinced me. I went into the institutional business. I was a bond salesman. I spent some time on the buy side. I worked at Merrill Lynch. I was a manager at Merrill Lynch. I managed clients. I managed an office. And that sort of gave me a taste for the option world. I kind of moved a little bit of my business from managed money into the annuity business. And for those who aren't aware, some of the largest users of derivatives or options are insurance companies because they tend to sell products, variable annuities, fixed annuities, where they need to hedge sort of these products where they have living benefits and they want to sort of sell short-term vol and buy long-term. Well, the financial crisis of 2008, I don't know if you were even around, I'm kidding, actually, during that time, but it's still eminent in everybody's mind. Things had changed, and I was with an insurance company, an annuity company at that time, and I was introduced to the Option Clearing Corporation, an incredible organization that just celebrated their 50th anniversary in Chicago. First, listed options traded again back in 1973, and here we are today. So I was brought on to what had really kind of been an offshoot of the CBOE and was an offshoot of the ISE. They had internal education, mainly to retail, mainly to institution, but not to advisors. That was sort of the holy grail. How do we get to the advisor community? Interestingly, because we're going to talk about market makers in a bit, but interestingly, the first line of defense, those that actually make investment decisions on behalf of their clients, are the ones that were sort of infrequently using options. I had done covered calls and some collar strategies when I was an advisor, but not really. So I came on board in 2009. I'll kind of abbreviate the story. The things that I'm actually most proud of, and maybe I'll share that at the end, but just a couple of highlights were that we actually introduced the first of its kind research, which was a qualitative research study on the DNA, the option usage of advisors, why they do it, why they don't do it, what type of strategies. John was one of the early adopters in 2011 of highlighting this research. I want to give a shout out to Steve Sears. He also was one of those great individuals and others in the industry, of course. And then two other things. We actually launched an option course through the former IMCA, I-M-C-A, now called IWA, still around, first of its kind, really that kind of highlighted how advisors can sort of take a deep dive into learning about options. And then lastly, which I'm also very proud of, was I, pre-COVID, I jumped into the deep end of the pool. This was on the kind of encouragement of the NASDAQ exchange and launched a podcast called Coffee with Kott, which happened for about a year and a half. And then I had a couple of stints here in with Interactive Brokers and some other firms, and actually my consulting firm is what I've been doing ever since.
And speaking of your consulting firm, I know you recently started that in 2022, I believe. So how did your previous career experiences help you start your own company, and what challenges did you face along the way?
An excellent question. And I fought against doing this for quite some time, really kind of during COVID and then after, when my girlfriend Sheila, my daughter Talia, and I'm sort of giving shout outs to really encouragement. One thing I would suggest to people is those around you, that, you know, your spouse, your family, your children, colleagues. One of my colleagues, Alan Grigoletto, who is sort of an icon in the derivative space, kept saying to me, look, I've done it, and you have the wherewithal, the tools necessary. So the premise, Esma, behind doing this was I wanted to build a bridge, a conduit between the buy side advisory family office, registered investment advisors, the folks that were going to look at the investments, then kind of bridge that gap between the exchanges, the asset managers, the market making community, all those on the sell side, and put those two together and be kind of a voice. And so the business was launched last year, and it's been exciting, a bit challenging, as anybody who starts their own business. You have to be, you kind of have to be courageous. You have to kind of roll. Again, this is probably an analogy with market makers where you have to see where there's an edge, and you also have to be aware of what the risks are. And, you know, we'll talk about that a little bit, but that's kind of, the premise was really to bridge the gap between the buy side and the sell side, mainly due to the fact that advisors, and even folks that are institutional, managers have deviated away from managing risk or mitigating risk and don't always think about options as a natural progression of when they manage assets. And I think there's a lot of misconceptions. There's a lot of things that aren't people aren't always they're a little bit reticent because of the intimidation.
Thank you for giving a little bit more insight on how you started your own company and then also some of your background in the derivative space. Now I want to kind of pivot our conversation to the main topic of this week, which is market makers in the options industry. So for those who don't know, can you give an overview of what a market maker is and what their role is in the options market?
Sure. And I preface it by saying I was never a trader. I was never a specialist. I was never a runner. I might have played one on TV. No, I'm kidding. I've been around it long enough where, again, being very blessed to be in the industry for a long time. One of the things that I would probably highlight for your listening audience is the market making community has changed a lot. What I'll do is kind of present first an analogy. I just bike rode this morning very early because it's hot here in Florida. So you have to hedge your bets by getting out there before it gets to 115 degrees. But let's use an example. Esma, if you and I are on either side, I'm looking to sell my bicycle, you're looking to buy one. So you sort of have an idea in your mind, you're looking to pay $1,000. Well, I'm looking to sell that bike at $1,500. If we don't really come together price-wise and are able to meet it's a futile effort of the purchase of the bike or the sell of the bike. If we bring a third party in, a bike store, like the market maker, they then are able to look at the marketplace and they're going to be the buyer when there's no buyers around. They'll be the seller when there aren't sellers around. And what they're trying to do is, in essence, they're either the hero or the villain of the marketplace, but they're looking to be an intermediary to be able to say, buy the bike from Eric, where they can actually buy it at a price that's fair and reasonable, keeping the market sort of, you know, healthy that way, and then trying to price it to you, the buyer, at a price that's attractive enough to you. So again, that analogy of thinking about the bike store, they're sort of the intermediary. And when we talk about market makers, I would encourage, you know, those who listen who are retail or advisory and such, that they play an important role in the options business. Mainly, you know, they're there to keep the markets efficient. They're there to keep liquidity. I'm referencing a time period right about the time that I started in 09, but in 08, there were roughly 2,000 market makers. There were about 100 in Canada. Currently, right now, that's less than 50. I mean, it's really, contracted dramatically. A lot of that has to do in the market making community is, I know we're going to talk about technology, and that's one of the areas that's kind of taken the market making community and shrunk it because it's really expensive with all this algorithmic technology and high frequency trading, which we'll talk about. But mainly, again, if I were to compare what's happened in the market making community, what you've seen is sort of similar to what Warren Buffett's done in the insurance business. You have this, what was a sort of fragmented business with mom and pop shops, and now you really have these major companies. I mean, all of us that watch TV, we see the Warren Buffett, Geico, Gecko, we see Progressive and stuff, but sort of bringing it back to the options business, it's these are professionals that are there to sort of make sure that things are functioning smoothly, and they really perform a very good function, again, because what they're doing is they're efficiently kind of keeping the marketplace at a level playing field where it's become that much more kind of seamless for those of us that are new to investing in the option arena, because it was quite different back in the days. I'll reference, and I do this a lot because I'll share with you, I bring up names because these are the folks that really were so good to me as I came in. Shelley Nattenberg is an icon also in the industry. And Shelley talks about the days when he used to work on the floor. And for those who didn't experience being on the floor, they kind of had to make up these spreads, which is the bid, and the ask, the bid where basically you're going to end up selling and the ask you're ending up buying. But back in those days, they sort of used a term called scalping. They kind of, I think they improvised because you didn't have the efficiencies in the marketplace. So that's kind of what took place. But, I talk about the idea that this idea of efficiency, but it's also transparency. It's another theme that I like to kind of reference because the transparency is that we're all able to see the bid and asks on the screen. A lot of the liquidity is there. I would say that, the difference between also market makers and brokers is, the brokers operate sort of as the retail component, and the market makers are wholesaling because the brokers are the ones who have sort of direct contact with the clients. They might be providing, research and stuff, but they're in sort of direct contact with the market maker, again, who is really the middleman, and kind of is enabling these transactions to take place.
So I really like that bike analogy you used. I think it kind of breaks it down on a very simple level. And I like how you talk about the market maker being kind of the middleman. So how do market makers manage the bid-ask spread of the option contract to kind of gain a profit?
So, it's a little bit different in the stock market versus the options market. And for a market maker, there are kind of a couple of determinants when they look at it. They're going to take a look at the volume that's out there. They're going to look at what we refer to as open interest, which is how many contracts are out there, what's outstanding, the current bid and ask, because there's not just one market maker. There's typically multiple market makers that handle multiple securities, that handle in the option business multiple types of option underlyings, equity, ETFs, index, and such. There's a lot of moving parts. And it's a pretty stressful job. Again, I'm not a market maker, but I can only imagine the anxiety because, the market maker's looking like any of us, and referencing back to the bike example, it's supply and demand. Might be a lot of bike stores out there, and you might be able to, pick and choose. And so that the pricing, when we talk about the bid and ask, I mean, market makers are not out there to make, incredible amounts of money. because again, they have to take on the risk. So they also need to attract folks that are looking to either buy or sell. Thus, the reason why they sometimes have used the term back in the day when I was talking about scalp, but they used to say you could drive a truck through the bid and offer spread or the bid and ask spread because spreads were so wide. And again, the community at the time knew how to kind of, let me not use the word manipulate. That's not the right word, but they knew how to sort of play the market a little bit that gave them a distinct advantage. That doesn't happen as much anymore, again, because we don't have as many market makers. And, you know, the other component I'd add to that as they start to figure out how to sort of price these things, there are other components that come into play, obviously, where the markets are in terms of, you know, the sentiment where, again, potentially even where rates are, what's going on in the, you know, in the economy. I mean, you know, all this comes in, but I go back to that one theme that's the most important is liquidity. And that's really what plays into this. Again, the market maker has to understand what their risk is because they're taking that on, but they also want to be competitive and post bid and asks that are going to bring in folks who want to be able to trade and that the execution could, you know, can benefit them. They also, you know, could go back to the COVID times of 2020 to 2021, 22. You can go back to the financial crisis of 08. You can go back even to 1987 in October. You know, those are outliers, but those are conditions that can really disrupt the market maker and how they actually have to adjust things.
So I'm really glad that you mentioned liquidity, actually, because that kind of segues into my next question. But what are some strategies that market makers can use to ensure liquidity in the options market?
Sure. So one is this sort of, you know, pricing model. You know, they want to make sure that things are efficiently priced. There were some concerns back during COVID with meme stocks, with other crypto, et cetera, that kind of was a little bit of a hiccup in terms of how market makers were pricing certain things. But, you know, again, it's, you know, competitively pricing things. You know, the market maker also needs to be aware of what's going on and might end up employing some sort of hedging strategy on their own. You know, one of the things that, you know, sort of give an example, if a market maker, you know, is long a call, they actually might, you know, end up shorting the stock because again, what they're trying to do is to buffer the risk. You know, again, they want to make sure because they're not looking really to hold positions. You know, the whole concept of investors is, you know, you buy low and you sell high. The market maker, it's again looking to try to find a little bit of that edge, which we call the spread in between the bid and the ask. Again, if they're showing a bit of 1,000 on that bike and a 1,050 on the ask, that $50 is their spread. Not tremendous. And really, like the top 100 names in the option world have very thin, you know, almost penny spreads on it because again, there's a lot of liquidity, there's a lot of volume, there's a lot of, you know, outstanding. So it's so in that respect, you know, it trades very tight. Other less liquid, you know, less kind of, you know, implemented underlyings that portfolio managers use or pensions, et cetera, hedge funds, you know, they might have a wider spread and the market maker has to, again, competitively analyze all the time how they're going to price these. It's not static. I mean, this is really kind of a, it requires a distinct management and a lot of the newer technology has allowed these market making firms, you know, whether it's Virtu or Citadel or, you know, JP Morgan, all these firms to have tremendous departments, you know, efficiently kind of looking at this all the time.
And you were just mentioning options with less liquid contracts. How would a market maker handle those kind of options?
Yeah, so one of the things that they might look at is if it's less liquid, they might try to narrow the bid ask spread. It's what they're looking to do again is and try to encourage investors, and kind of keep the flow going. They might also potentially, sort of absorb, when things are a little bit bearish, they might absorb some of the selling pressure. They might step in and kind of create sort of like a floor if if things are going on. They might also, look to, sort of adjust their positions if the markets are changing. They might want to sort of balance out their portfolio again. But what I said, this hedging, they'll look to maybe, maybe facilitate short sales. They might look to manage, vol in a marketplace where VIX is trading at a lower level. They might come in and, and again, and try to do some dynamic hedging. So it, they might also, we did see this during the 08 financial crisis. We saw this in 2011 in August when you had the Russian, well, you had the U.S. default, you had the crisis in Russia all in that time, and you have sort of collaboration of market makers with the regulators. And I don't mean like collaboration behind the scenes. I mean, that they, you, th those that are listening are familiar in the last, sort of 10 plus years, even a little bit further than that. We have circuit breakers now. I mean, I'm showing my age, I apologize, but I could go back to say that I remember when, the first ETF traded 30 years ago, actually, 30 years ago this year, SPYs traded. But circuit breakers were something that didn't exist in 87. And the market just, again, went parabolically, down. But overall, I think it's this, it's the participation by the market makers. It's communication. It's promoting the sense of this sort of predictable and orderly marketplace where, the active participation is really important. And I have to give kudos to the exchanges. I think they do a great job. I'm going to give a silent shout out to Lothian and others who provide the education so the investing public understands that there's no collusion going on. There is not. I mean, the market maker, they communicate with traders, they communicate with the exchanges, they communicate with advisors. I mean, they really, I would say they mitigate this excessive volatility. They're really an integral part of the overall efficiency of the market. I think that it's a critical aspect of the whole mechanics and ecosystem, especially in the options business.
And to kind of piggyback off of my earlier question, how do market makers manage and assess risks when trading options with these less liquid contracts?
Yeah, with again, w where it comes with the less liquidity, it circles back to this idea of do they tighten spreads to encourage more? I mean, do they are they looking to kind of create a little bit more of a of an environment where they can bring in more participants, and it that in turn goes to this point of market makers communicating with exchanges, communicating and making sure that there isn't this sort of there isn't this Reddit communication that comes out sometimes in social media that says that we've got short sellers and the market is really not kind of working in favor of the individual investors. So I think it's monitoring this market activity. It's monitoring the flow, and with I would say with decades of expertise from the market making community, they're looking at the market. They might have to adjust, pricing and strategies, to sort of account for this sort of volatility and stabilization.
I know you just briefly mentioned order flow, but how do they adjust their pricing strategies according to current market sentiment?
So to the current, again, they're going to look at certain indicators. Again, we talk about the fear index with VIX. They'll look at the you know, sort of where the open interest is. They're gonna take a look at you know, where the underlyings are that relate back to you know, these contracts. And they'll go ahead and, you know, it, one of the things they you know, they talk about is risk premium, where you know, what is this percentage that you're going to take to get that expected you know, percentage return. And so in the context of that, they'll, you know, they might look to minimize some of this you know, again, by being more of a seller in the marketplace to kind of maybe lift the marketplace, or conversely, you know, be a buyer if there isn't enough activity going on.
And market sentiment and market volatility, they're pretty closely related. And actually, you mentioned it a few times earlier, but how do market makers stabilize market volatility during bearish conditions?
Yeah, during the bearish conditions, that's their challenge. I mean, you know, again, if it sort of relates to this, when things are less liquid, there's sensitivity in it. And what they, you know, market makers work off of sort of these estimations, these volatility estimations. They look at their pricing models, where their positions are, what they have in inventory, and, you know, it, you know, they want to balance and adjust things. And so they'll, you know, it's a unique challenge because they had at times not really been in a bear market with a 12-year bull market, but they'll tighten spreads when need be. They have to sort of adaptable. There's you know, again, if there's new developments or news that comes out related to the market, they might have certain algorithms that are going to make the decision at the time for them. But in any market scenario, especially in a bearish scenario, Esma, it's about the liquidity, and it comes back to that that idea that if they can keep, you know, the this spread at a place where they're going to still see activity, you know, at times they might have to take on, again, that's that position limit, they might have to take on more, and that occurred during 08 at times, and again talking to market makers that I know, they had to facilitate this sort of trading activity during times of COVID, you know, just to maintain this orderly trading.
So a lot of it's about like adjusting the spread depending on where the situation is with the markets.
It correlates well with this this volatility management, because you know, it you're looking to keep things stable. Otherwise, that things get so wide, you're not gonna have activity, and it sort of dries up, and that could create some real issues, not only in the option, you know, arena, but also, you know, it crosses over into, you know, into stocks and bonds as well. Sure.
So moving on to a different situation for market makers, mm-hmm. What strategies would they use to facilitate very large trades in the options market?
Sure. You know, and in terms of big block trading, which a lot of, you know, sort of the larger, the Citadels and the Virtus such, they're typically going to be wanting to trade very quickly. So they might, profit in essence by charging, you know, higher on the ask than their bid, and you know, again, that's that spread that they have, but they want to be in really quickly. They tend to reassess their risk, and they're going to focus more on what can they match quickly, and they want to, sort of minimize the risk and be able to maintain, this active market. So they'll, again, quantify this risk premia, but they want to kind of be in, they want to be compensated, but they want to be neutral. So they'll probably raise their ask, and profit from that, in terms of not having, the market move against them, in a way that leaves them vulnerable.
So I think my next question is kind of switching gears a little bit here. And I know you were actually mentioning it towards the beginning of the interview about technology, but how have advancements in technology impacted the role of market makers in recent years?
The two things that I'd mention about technology, and it really blossomed when I had entered the educational realm in 2009 when I was with the OIC, was the prolification of HFTs, these high frequency trading firms. And, the algorithmic, prior to that, you had firms that would hire PhDs from the University of Chicago or from MIT or from Stanford. And you'd have folks, because I spent a little bit of time with one of the goats of the option business, and that was my former chairman at Interactive Brokers, Thomas Peterffy, who, for those who are keeping score, was really the grandfather of electronic trading, because he actually created the device that revolutionized trading from the paper trading to electronic apparatus and thus. But the reason I mentioned Thomas is that Thomas saw also the benefit to offering algorithms and all this type of technology to their clientele, but it changed a lot for the market making community and trading, because what it did was it gave sort of these enhancements for speed, efficiency, risk management. It certainly helped to improve overall liquidity. There's no doubt about that, and that's always good for the financial markets. It gave the advent of firms that are very much on people's minds because they use them right now, which is Robinhood or eToro or Webull and others. But this automation and the algorithms in terms of these electronic trading platforms were absolutely integral in increasing what a lot believe is the volume growth cleared by the OCC. Cost came down, not only to trade, but for market data and analysis, and it gave the investor on Main Street, Esma, the opportunity to have the same technology that the bigger banks, the bigger institutions could use. And we go back to an original comment for all of this discussion on market making. I believe it shrunk and narrowed bid offers, and it made it a little bit, the technology put pressure on sort of the traditional market maker, and they had to come up with new ways to stay competitive. And so, you also started to see, a lot more sort of advanced spread trading, which happened for advisors, mainly most of them would stick to, the basics of collars and puts and cover calls. But, they started to implement multi-leg strategies and straddles and triangles. And it became apparent that it was a more competitive marketplace, and that I think what's happening is there's continual innovation in order to sort of stay relevant.
Well, I think thank you for talking a little bit more about market makers in the options industry. That kind of concludes my main questions about market makers. I have a few final questions just to wrap up the conversation a little bit. My first one being is, what are some of the most important lessons you've learned while working with derivatives in your career?
I would say that it comes back to what market makers think about, having a little bit of an edge and managing your risk. And I say that humorously or facetiously, but it really does. It kind of means that you really have to kind of take on a little bit of risk, but also manage that risk. And one of the things I've taken away from the derivative industry is that it is an incredible community. I really feel blessed to have entered it at the time, and I did. I'm still very fortunate to be working with a lot of those folks that I did back in my early days when I was creating research, when I was doing events on the floor of the NYSE or Cboe or NASDAQ, and also doing podcast. It is just it's a very generous community, and we're only at the cusp of it. Think about it. I mean, I'm in my 50s. 73 is when it started. We didn't see puts until 77. You now have these zero dated options, and I'll throw out to John because John would remember the mini contracts, which really never took off. That was like the Yugo. It came out and then it didn't did away with. But overall, I feel like this is an industry that's growing. I encourage a lot of the younger folks that would be listening to this to take a look at getting into this industry because it's dynamic, it's exciting, and there are wonderful people that are in it that you can learn a lot from, like I have and work with.
And what advice would you give to someone who's looking to get into this industry?
The first place I would go is contacting the exchanges. They have an incredible internship program from the MIAX to the again the NASDAQ, the Cboe, NYSE, the BOX. I mean, I'm probably forgetting there are so many exchanges out there now. When I started, there were only six. But that's a great place. And then to the market, the big market makers that are out there, they're always looking for folks to come in who have, and again, you don't have to have a mathematical theoretical quant background. People come from all disciplines in their undergraduate and graduate studies, but it's an exciting global market for derivatives that is only going to increase, and it's a place that I would encourage younger folks to take a look at.
Thank you for giving a little bit more advice on how to get involved in the industry. So every week we choose a topic for the show. Do you have any recommendations for a topic that we could cover just to learn a little bit more about options?
My suggestion might be the buffered income strategies that we're seeing a lot in the exchange traded fund industry. We've really kind of seen this parabolic growth in what are like a structured product, but built into ETFs. And we're seeing a lot more of that. And I think that's added a lot of the increase in volume over the last couple of years cleared by the OCC. So my selfish recommendation might be having a discussion about buffered income protected ETFs, and I'd be happy to bring on a couple of my colleagues who could probably speak a little bit more in depth about the mechanics of those strategies and where they see them going.
Thanks for that suggestion. I'm always kind of looking for different topics to cover on the show. But again, this is all I have for you today, and I want to thank you again for coming on. I know I learned quite a bit, and I'm sure our viewers did too.
Esma, thank you so much, and thank John and the whole community for having me on. I really appreciate it.
If you're hungry for more options content, make sure to subscribe to the JLN YouTube channel and check out our social media accounts. Be sure to check out our website, johnlothiannews.com, MarketsWiki, and the John Lothian newsletter for more content.